I believe we have come to an agreement. We're still working out details, but I feel very optimistic.
State lawmakers reach a compromise on oil and gas tax credits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 14th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a new fungus has some scientists worried.
Right now, I'm considering it potentially a significant threat, and I will be incredibly happy to be wrong about that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska. Their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
State lawmakers say they're close to an agreement on a bill that would end tax credits to oil and gas companies that can be traded for cash. Through yesterday, the House and Senate couldn't agree on how to replace cash credits. Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr and Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel have been the lead negotiators in talks. Here's Geisel.
I believe we have come to an agreement. We're still working out details, but I feel very optimistic. The negotiations have been challenging, but very productive. I have appreciated working with Representative Tarr and the communication that we've had.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson also says the talks have been positive. He says it appears there's going to be an agreement in Juneau.
There's always some hesitancy about whether this is really going to happen. It appears that it might. And that's why I flew here. And that's why I think by tomorrow morning, there should be close to 60 legislators in town.
Neither side will say what the details of the agreement are. Senators have sought to maintain oil and gas companies' ability to use losses to reduce their future taxes. House members want companies to pay more in taxes. Both chambers are scheduled to meet on Saturday morning. The second special session must end by midnight tomorrow. Moody's has downgraded the state's credit rating again and says the state has a negative outlook. A report from the credit agency cites multiple reasons for the change, including the state's $2.5 billion draw from its reserves to cover the budget, its large pension obligation, and its continued lack of a long-term fiscal plan. The agency also notes that while the economy of the United States as a whole is growing, Alaska's economy is shrinking, and the state has the highest unemployment rate in the nation. Governor Bill Walker issued a statement saying the downgrade to AA3 is concerning but not surprising. Late last month, another credit agency, Standard & Poor's, put the state on a credit watch. A major Haynes infrastructure project that is years in the making may have to wait a little longer. Construction on the Haynes Highway Improvement Project was expected to begin this fall, but the Alaska legislature's failure to agree on a capital budget could delay this and more than 20 other transportation projects. Without a state capital budget, the Alaska Department of Transportation can't access millions of dollars in federal money for infrastructure developments. DOT spokeswoman Ora Landau says the department anticipated advertising the Haynes project for construction bids in late July. It will have to put that off until a capital spending plan is passed. Landau says the Federal Highway Administration fiscal year ends September 30th. If the capital budget is still in limbo at that time, it would cause a more serious delay. The legislature passed an operating budget in June, narrowly avoiding a government shutdown. It is meeting now in special session focused on oil tax legislation that ends tomorrow. The Haynes Highway renovation isn't the only DOT infrastructure project affected by the capital budget. The Marine Highway Ferry Tustamina replacement is the highest dollar item on the list. Road and bridge renovations from Ketchikan to Fairbanks are also affected. The Alaska State Museums are set to receive the National Medal for Museum and Library Service in Washington, D.C. next week. It's the highest recognition of its kind. The director of a new cultural heritage center in Clukwan is part of the group receiving the award in the nation's capital. KHNS's Abby Collins reports.
The Chilkat Kwan Cultural Heritage Center opened in the Chilkat Indian village of Clukwan last spring. Here's Executive Director Lonnie Hotch on a tour of the museum.
We do the hooligan fishing in the spring, and so there's photos showing that process, catching the hooligan and fermenting them. And
Hotch says they got a lot of help from the Alaska State Museums as the cultural center was being developed.
We couldn't have done it without them.
She says the state museums helped in a number of different ways.
They helped us get our, you know, museum organizational stuff put together. They taught us some basic skills for handling artifacts and things.
They even helped with the design of the building itself. The Heritage Center houses some of the most renowned pieces of Northwest Coast art, the Whale House Collection. Hotch says the state museums aided with documentation and conservation work of some of those art pieces. Hotch is attending the National Medal Awards ceremony as a community representative. Patience Fredrickson will also be there to accept the award. She's the director of the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums at the Alaska Department of Education.
It's a huge honor to get this. For us, it feels like it is a validation of work that the state museums, the one in Juneau and the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka, have been doing for many, many years.
The museums in Juneau and Sitka are the only two state museums in Alaska, but they also do outreach and provide development resources to museums throughout the state. Fredrickson says having Hotch at the ceremony is representative of that aspect of the organization's mission.
Most museums, when they go, they bring a member of their community, of their town. In our case, our community is all of Alaska, so having Lonnie come is really great. Another large community that we serve are Alaska Natives, and to have somebody who's from a museum that is Alaska Native sort of doubles up on the two types of communities that we do serve.
10 libraries and museums from across the country are receiving the national recognition. The award ceremony will be held at the National Archives Museum on Monday. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
A fungus that's damaged trees in south central and interior Alaska has been discovered in southeast, but there's a chance its spread could be stopped. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Forest pathologist Robin Mulvey takes me to the Shrine of St. Therese on a forested island about 20 miles northwest of downtown Juneau. So is this where it was?
Yes, so right here you can see a small tree. It's about 4 inches in diameter, and it's just a stump now because we removed that tree. This was a fairly heavily infected tree, at least in the lower branches.
The infection was spruce bud blight, which damages or kills the growing tips of branches. It was discovered here in late June, the first reported sighting in the region. The blight could be a problem because it infects Sitka spruce, one of the most common trees in southeast Alaska's rainforest.
Right now, I'm considering it potentially a significant threat, and I will be incredibly happy to be wrong about that.
As crows call in the background, Mulvey, who works for the U.S. Forest Service, explains that the tungus has just what the disease likes.
The ideal weather conditions for the pathogen are temperatures between 55 and 65 degrees Fahrenheit with precipitation. And if you've been in Juneau this summer, you know we've had very conducive weather conditions for this pathogen.
The fungus is not easy to spot. It's black and looks like a dead crusty coating on the buds. It's actually a group of small spherical fruiting structures. And if it doesn't kill a bud, it hampers its growth, leaving another sign, a small twisted branch with few needles.
This is going to spread through spores moving on the air, and it's also going to spread through spores moving through rain splash.
But no one's sure how the spruce bud blight found its way to this one small patch of southeast forest. She says they were looking for another pathogen, the spruce aphid, when they came across the infestation. Spruce bud blight was first found in Homer 4 years ago, though it took until last year to figure out what it was. It's also been identified elsewhere on the Kenai Peninsula and in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Forest Service plant pathologist Lori Winton, who's based in Fairbanks, says her first encounter was also a surprise.
And the first time I saw it, I was skiing in the forest, and I pretty much fell face first right into the tree that had it.
That was about 2 years ago, and it wasn't clear what it was. Then, an article in a scientific journal described outbreaks on blue spruce plantations in Central Europe's Czech Republic.
So then suddenly, there were DNA sequences available that matched, so I had an identification. And frankly, it was a rather alarming identification.
The potential for extensive damage in Southeast's forests, or those statewide, is not known. And since no one's sure how it got to Alaska, it's not clear how rapidly it could spread. Winton says there's also a chance spruce bud blight could have been here all along and just hadn't been spotted. After all, it is a big state. She says it could take a year of lab work to figure that out. Back in Juneau, Mulvey wonders about the same question.
Part of me says, what are the chances that we detected the only site of infection in Juneau? And I think the chances are pretty small.
But if it isn't here naturally, there's a chance it could be stopped. Her team is continuing its search for spruce bud blight in Southeast. It's also asking for the public's help. She suggests checking landscape plants on your own property. That's because it seems most common in developed areas. But if you find it, she suggests contacting an expert because removing branches or cutting a tree can spread the fungus. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Reds are running strong, but where are the Kings in Kilgannik?
After they get the Kings, we head gut, slab, strip, salt.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The contentious contract negotiations between the Wrangell Borough and the IBEW are over. The Wrangell Borough Assembly approved an amended contract with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers during a special meeting Thursday. Union members went on strike in June after the Assembly approved a contract that the union had rejected. The strike ended when both sides agreed to return to the bargaining table. The amendment approved on Thursday is the result of those continued talks. It changes how much the borough will cover of medical premium costs for employees hired before 2011. Union members ratified the agreement on Monday. 24 Wrangell utility and other employees are represented by the IBEW. Another 35 management and non-union staff members also work for the borough. More than 2.5 million sockeye have returned to spawn in the Nooshigak River this year, one of the highest counts on record. They have filled pools and creeks, jumping and swimming their way into the spawning grounds. But in Kilgannik, the Nooshigak's uppermost village, king salmon are conspicuously missing from the nets. KDLG's Avery Lill has the story.
This is where we, after they get the kings, we head gut, slab, strip, salt, and then we hang all our strips out here to dry.
Long strips of king salmon hang outside Diane Ishnuk's Kilgannik smokehouse.
Then when they're all dry, we bring them into the smokehouse here.
Inside her smokehouse, it smells sharply of cottonwood smoke and salmon, which hangs from wooden racks. The big kings are cut into strips. The jack kings are simply split in half and dried as a sheet. But these kings aren't from Kilgannik. Local families have had to travel to places like New Stuyahok and Lewis Point to catch their fill. Many in Kilgannik do that every year to get an earlier start on processing fish, but this year, even families who usually get their kings near the village went downriver. Ishnuk and her family set their nets off to Mogalituli, or in English, Cranberry Creek. In 3 weeks, she caught one king, her sister got two in 2 weeks.
Normally, we would catch up to 30 or 40 a day, like 18 in the morning or 15 at night. We'd have to check it twice a day.
Local elder George Nelson usually catches 100 to 150 kings at Kilgannik in a season. After setting his net for a month, he's only caught six or seven. Ishnuk says people are puzzled as to why the kings have not arrived yet. She also has another theory.
Well, we were thinking that maybe there's so many reds, they're like pushing the kings out to the middle of the river.
If that's the case, she thinks king salmon may simply be escaping the nets set for them. Frances Nelson is also from Koliganek. Like Ishnuk, her smokehouse is full of kings caught downriver, but she is sure that there are king salmon near Koliganek as well.
I think there were lots of kings in the river. I don't ever want to say there's a shortage of kings in this river. That's just talk. You know, if those downriver people harvested all the kings that they did down at the mouth of the Nooshigak River in Dillingham, Clark's Point, you know there were a lot of kings coming up this river.
Sport fishing provides another perspective on the unusually low king catches in set nets. Katrina Merlino, the Village Indian Environmental General Assistance Program coordinator, says that people who sport fish for a full day are catching upwards of 6 kings.
Usually the nets catch a lot more than you do rod and reel. I really think that the kings are coming up in the middle channel and, you know, riding along the banks, because right where all the rod and reel fishers are, they go right where there's still water and right in the current, and they leave their line right there, and seems like that's where they're catching the most.
While no one in Koliganek can do more than hypothesize about why the kings are hitting the nets so sparsely, there seems to be little concern. Freezers are full, and most people have already smoked as many fish as they'll need for the year. Nelson takes a no-nonsense attitude toward the whole situation.
People all along this river have gotten their king salmon. You know, it's just a different year, a different season. You know, as Alaska Native people, we always know how to adjust to change.
The coming years will tell whether this year's run is an anomaly or whether it's indicative of a long-term shift in the way salmon run up the Nooshigak. In Koliganek, I'm Avery Lill.
Low water levels on the Nooshigak River are still thwarting barge efforts to travel upriver as well. Mike Poston, director of sales at Vitus Energy, says it's typical for the river to run low and deliveries to lag at this point in the summer. What's unusual is that the river has been low since it opened up. He says normally they get barges upriver when snowmelt raises the water levels. Poston says they aren't concerned because the weather forecast bodes well for barge deliveries later this summer or fall.
In these days of climate change, you really don't know what you're going to get. But the one thing that we do have to go by is the long-range projections from NOAA, and they're saying normal precipitation for this area. So with that in mind, we are optimistic that the rains will come when they're supposed to come. We'll need quite a bit of that before we can get going.
The villages of Nustuyahok and Koliganek are still waiting on their first barge of the year. Nustuyahok is conserving heating fuel. Businesses are limited to 50 gallons per month, and homes are limited to 30 gallons. Some Koliganek residents say they haven't felt the impacts yet. This is not the first time in recent years that water levels on the Nooshigak have been low. In 2014, low water levels postponed barge deliveries, which delayed construction of the school in Koliganek. And still thinking about buying the state ferry Taku? The state extended the bidding deadline for the 54-year-old ship again until August 8th. A spokesperson says it's because an interested buyer wants to tour it. The minimum bid for the 350-passenger vessel is still a secret.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Bernard Memorial Sports Center in Wasilla. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Lumberjacks and Princesses. Juneau residents have a chance to catch the world premiere of a new burlesque show tonight. But it's not your grandma's cabaret. This style is called boylesque, where men perform sultry roles in a genre pioneered by women. One of the troupe's founding members is from Juneau and has made it a point to bring his art back to his home city. KTOO's Annie Bartholomew has more.
Under purple, ethereal light, a figure slinks around a folding chair,
Cloaked in black sheer fabric, the body floats across stage, personifying the angel of death and blurring the lines of gender expression. Then, he starts peeling away layers of clothing. It's part of Maude Carousel's newest show, Gilded, which is making its world premiere in Alaska. For 8 years, Seneca Harper has brought boylesque, that's men performing burlesque, back to his hometown of Juneau.
Growing up here is really wonderful and it's really interesting, but I also felt like there was a lot of culture missing that I knew existed somewhere but didn't know where it was and felt like I needed to leave Juneau to be part of that.
He was first introduced to boylesque in Seattle, where he found his conspirators and future husband.
Coming back, I feel like I went out in the world, discovered a little gem, and then I'm kind of bringing it home, saying, here, look at this for a little while, and people seem to really enjoy that.
The group travels with more than 300 pounds of luggage, costumes, and props. Most are custom sewn by Harper's husband, Paris Original. Since forming their collective in 2010, they've held residencies in London and Australia, garnered 5 million YouTube hits, and performed in more than 50 countries. Burlesque has a long history as a medium for political satire, parody, and social commentary, inspired by Lydia Thompson and the British Blondes, who first brought Victorian burlesque to America in the 1860s. In their newest show, Gilded, the group explores themes of gender expression, race, and ethnicity, all in the classical burlesque format. A performer enters the stage, establishes a storyline and character through dance and physical movement, eventually shedding layers of clothing to reveal some kind of moral. It's almost always comedic. Even though the guys are taking their clothes off, they distinguish their work from strippers like Chip and Dale's and Magic Mike. Trojan Original says their audiences are diverse.
I think a healthy amount of our audience thinks it's going to be a strip show, and then they're pleasantly surprised, and then the other half thinks it's definitely not going to be a strip show, and then they're also pleasantly surprised. So at the end of the day, everyone's pleasantly surprised.
Harper says the difference between burlesque and stripping is the intent and artistry behind these routines. Stripping seeks to arouse the audience and is mostly about what the performer looks like underneath their clothes. In burlesque, there are no limitations on body type. Performers serve to engage the audience psychologically through humor, costumes, and clever reveals. Dancer Moscato Extatique says for members of Maude Carousel who grew up in the ballet tradition, burlesque offers an alternative to the rigid gender roles assigned to males.
Men have a very specific lace and dance. I mean, especially in the classical world where you're presenting the woman and you're being the strong masculine prince. And Paris and I are not that man in burlesque. So burlesque is that place for us to be as effeminate or masculine as we want.
Harper says he's always felt somewhere in between gender-wise. And as his persona, the luminous pariah, he gets to present that on stage.
When it comes down to at the end of the road, do I have to be a lumberjack or do I have to be a princess?
He says with boylesque, he can be both at the same time, and that's both liberating and gratifying. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
You can see Gilded live at Juneau's Rockwell Ballroom tonight, and at Mad Myrna's in Anchorage on July 22nd. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Doreen Cooper from Skagway. She's working as a volunteer at the Arctic Interagency Visitor Center in Coldfoot.
I came to Alaska in 1992 to work for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park as an archaeologist. And that was kind of my midlife crisis. I had visited Alaska once in 1986. I was just like, yeah, I'm ready for something different. And so I did, and I was really tired of the summers in Texas. So now I'm tired of the winters in Alaska. So I worked for them for 7 years, and while I was there, I met my husband, the man that I'm married to now. And so he was from Skagway, so I stayed in Skagway. And after my job with the Park Service ended, I worked for the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad, and I was Skagway's magistrate for a couple years. And I continued to do archaeology, and I was also an office manager for some people in Skagway who owned four stores. and we retired in September, and now we're up here volunteering. My husband was working on the Chilkoot Trail, and I would hike up every other weekend up to his trail camp above the Chilkoot Trail and just spending weekends there because it's the most beautiful place in the world. They have a small cabin there that they actually built by hand, bringing up rocks from the river for the foundations, and they had tents on rocks around them, and they actually had hot and cold running water from a creek that was close by, so they didn't use it, but I sure did. And would go up there and would listen to the radio, would listen to NPR on Saturday mornings, and then they went off to work, and it was just a great place to read and kick back, and the rare sunny day, lay out in the helicopter pad, which we weren't supposed to do. Maybe next spring we're looking at Bandelier ruins down in New Mexico. We've talked with them about doing some volunteer work, and next summer, haven't quite decided whether Alaska or Roy hasn't seen any of the great parks of the West, so we're kind of open.
Doreen Cooper lives in Skagway. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Bartholomew, Rasha McChesney, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Files and Abby Collins and Haynes, Ed Schoenfeld and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I am Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.